All right. Well, again, good to see you guys again. So tonight we're going to be on lesson 11, I believe. And I wanted to start by going over the outline again. I had this slide on lesson one, just kind of breaking down the structure of the book. If you remember back in the first nine chapters, were actually kind of in that structure of like the speeches, kind of from a father to a son. And then starting in chapter 10 through the first half of 22, we've been looking at more of those kind of one verse proverbs, cover a variety of topics. Our last six lessons have really been different topics covered through that section. And so today we're really going to enter, I think, is a new section of the book where the structure changes again. It kind of the sayings aren't restricted to just one verse anymore. They're a little bit longer. It goes back to like that father-son structure again as well, and it just kind of has like a new introduction to the section. It talks about being the words of the wise. You don't know who these wise men are. It seems likely that Solomon is preparing these sayings, but it very well could be from, other wise men sayings that Solomon gathered. We don't know too much about that. But again, we're in a different section of the book. It's still going to be organized somewhat randomly. So, the topics kind of jump around and, but we're going to do our best to, you have to kind of trust my judgment on what I've kind of selected or pulled out of there for us to talk about. We certainly won't be able to cover all 2.5 chapters, but, let's see. All right. So I'm going to pull up here. So this is the introduction to the section, starting in 22 and verse 17. I'll go ahead and read this. It says, "Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply your heart to my knowledge, for it will be pleasant if you keep them within you, if all of them are ready on your lips, that your trust may be in the Lord. I have made them known to you today, even to you. Have I not written for you 30 sayings of counsel and knowledge to make you know what is right and true, that you may give a true answer to those who sent you?" Again, so this is kind of the introduction again to a new section. And you see, it's very similar to that section 1 through 9 where he's urging the son to listen to these words. They're full of knowledge and counsel and what's right and true. So again, very similar to how 1 through 9 started. It seems like he's even urging him to memorize these, be able to recite them. He talks about having them ready on your lips. So know them well enough to where you can, you can speak them to someone else or just for your own good, right? Whenever you need these, and they'll bring blessing and pleasantness to you. I really like what he says there in the middle, where he says that these sayings are so that you would trust in the Lord, right? So we've tried to emphasize that throughout, about the emphasis in this book about our relationship with the Lord, how wisdom kind of starts there as the basis. The beginning is the fear of the Lord, and then through seeking wisdom, we grow even, we gain more understanding about who God is, and we grow closer to Him. And I think he's emphasizing that again. When we seek this wisdom and we see how these sayings play out in our lives, it ought to help us grow closer to God and to trust Him more. And I would say even when we see wisdom propped up in the world and by those who don't even realize that it's from God or from the book of Proverbs or from the scriptures, we see that propped up as true, and we recognize who the source is, and that ought to really just give us even more trust in God, that even those who don't know where it's coming from hold it up to be true. So at the end here, he talks about giving a true answer to those who sent you. I don't exactly know who's sending him or if that's literal. It could be figurative, in the sense that what I'm telling you, it's true to the point where you can take it back to someone and report it to them, right? You know, that it's a statement of confidence about how true it is, right? So, you know, you can take it back to someone who sent you. Again, don't know if that's literal or figurative. But he says he arranged 30 sayings. And so what we have in this section we're going to talk about today are our 30 sayings. I tried to go through and I tried to count them out and break them up myself, and I kept getting 31. But I'm sure I wasn't breaking up the thoughts the right way. But anyway, there's 30 sayings here in this section. And again, we're not going to be able to talk about all of them, but we'll talk about a few. All right, so I first want to talk about a few that have to do with the value of wisdom. I know we've covered this up to this point quite a lot, but as it's the main theme of the book, I feel like it's worth emphasizing each time we get to it. So I want to look at a few of these sayings that talk about the value of wisdom. Here in chapter 23 and 22 through 25, he says, "Listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she is old. Buy truth and do not sell it. Buy wisdom, instruction, and understanding. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice. He who fathers a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and mother be glad. Let her who bore you rejoice." So Wednesday, you know, we talked about relationships. At the end, we talked about the responsibilities of parents to their children. We didn't really get to the point of being able to say a lot about children's responsibility to their parents, but we certainly see some of that here in this saying, right? What's the children's responsibility to their parents? Well, it's to listen, right? To listen to the instruction that's being given to the things that they're saying. For some reason, I cut off verse 26 off of this. 23:26 says, "My son, give me your heart and let your eyes observe my ways." So listen to their instruction, observe their ways, give them, you know, respect and honor all throughout your life for what they've given you. And I think we see here what makes parents of adult children proud. Not how successful they are, you know, or wealthy they are, but it's, you know, a wise son or daughter, a righteous son or daughter. So wisdom and righteousness is what's going to make, you know, your parents proud even as you grow up. All right, so he emphasizes here, buy wisdom, instruction, and understanding, right? So, you know, stock up on it, right? Get as much as you can. Stock up on it like it's bread and milk before a snowstorm or something. You know, buy as much as you can of it, stock up on it. But it's interesting here, he adds something that, or a word in here that he hasn't used too much throughout the book. He talks about buying truth. And he hasn't used that word too much in the book. I think it's inherent in what he said about wisdom before this, but he's emphasizing here about, you know, stocking up on truth, right? So this wisdom that we're buying and stocking up on, you know, it is truth. These are true, wise statements, you know. So I suppose you could have sayings or proverbs that sound really good, and maybe they're just soothing to someone in the way that they sound. But, you know, if they don't actually turn out and you know, the end is not what the proverb said it will be, then is it really valuable at all? Is it really wise? Well, no. So it's worth emphasizing that, you know, this is truth, the things that we're looking at today. So buy truth and wisdom, instruction, understanding, you know, stock up on that. I'm going to move, again, somewhat quickly to the next couple here. So, again, this is 24 verses 3 through 7. Does someone mind reading this particular saying, 24, 3 through 7? To read it from your Bible or read it on the screen, whichever you prefer.
I will. "By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. By knowledge, the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. A wise man is full of strength, and a man of knowledge enhances his might. For by wise guidance, you can wage your war. And in abundance of counselors, there is victory. Wisdom is too high for a fool. In the gate, he does not open his mouth.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So how would you guys summarize this saying, or what's it saying about wisdom?
Wisdom creates stability, and getting that stability and that wisdom, I love verse 6, takes an abundance of counselors.
Yeah.
So if I can make a quick comment about that, like, one of the things that I've appreciated in this particular class on Proverbs that hasn't stood out to me before is that the repetition that we keep seeing, I mean, we've had verses about wisdom, we've had verses about our house and the Lord, that repetition is reminding me as a parent how many times I need to go over these same topics with my kids day after day, week after week, month after month, and how God as the ultimate father is going, like, there's more than one conversation about being a hard worker. There's more than one conversation about being disciplined. That's really stood out to me this time. So I like that it's repeated again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If something's repeated that much, it's got to be important, right? Yeah, and worth our repeating quite often. Yeah. Yeah, well said. Yeah, only with wisdom can we build something that's strong, that's established, that's stable, like you said, Philip, with a foundation to stand on. I think the house here is metaphorical. Maybe there's lessons about the home, but metaphorically, if you're going to build something that's going to stand, like a house, a structure, wisdom is going to allow it to be that. And it's a house full of blessings as well. And a wise man is strong. He's able to wage war and achieve victory. And with wisdom, you're able to, wage the war that is life, if you will. Challenges of this life, difficult situations, and overcome adversity through wisdom. Yeah. Lastly here, in 24:13-14, my son, eat honey, for it is good, and the drippings of the honeycomb are sweet to your taste. Know that wisdom is such to your soul. If you find it, there will be a future, and your hope will not be cut off. Again, so the goodness of wisdom really it can't be overstated, right? Throughout the whole book, it's, put here poetically as the drippings of the honeycomb, right? So the goodness can't be overstated, and there's a future and a hope that comes with it. Anything else you guys have to add, maybe about the value of wisdom, maybe any of these sayings or any of the others in this section that you noticed that talk about wisdom?
Jake, I would like to make a comment about young people and finding truth.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do have grandchildren, I observe they are bombarded through the internet and their friends and TikTok and, so much information is coming to them that is not truth. So we, as grandparents, as friends of them, whatever, when they question something, we need to find out and help them on the source of this. I think that's a challenge for us as teachers, as church members, to help them find the truth, because there's lots of misinformation given out to them daily. So that's why I love Philip's comment on repetition.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you, Paula. Yeah. It said, buy truth. So, get stock up on what's really truth, right? I mean, that's hopefully going to be a defense against all the other so-called, truths or other you know, views that you know, young people and people of any age really are subject to. So, you know, stock up on the real thing and let's do our best to help them get that, right? So they'll be rich in what's actually true. Yeah. All right. Next, we're going to look at a few sayings that have to do with our behavior or attitude towards rulers. There's a couple in here that speak, I think, specifically to that. The first one being here in 22 and verse 29, where he says, "Do you see a man skillful in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men." What do you guys make of this one? What's this one saying?
Jake, this one's one of my favorites. So that was my pause that was long enough to let somebody else jump in. But, you know, my dad is a copper worker, and it is hard to find people that know, like, as a craftsman, how to manipulate the copper and seal it up and make sure that it doesn't leak. And it's so interesting to see the different clients that he ends up being invited to work for, whether it's country music stars in Nashville or other, like, the castle that he's working on right now in Murfreesboro. People want someone that will do a job right and will do it well. And the idea of verse 29 is that quality rises to the top over time, and quality builds reputation. And I think that this verse is a reminder that when you start, whether you're just bagging groceries at Publix or wherever you start doing the job to the best of your abilities, and you try to maintain that.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think two examples in the Bible are Joseph and Daniel. You know, they stood out. Joseph even in prison, and Daniel even eating bread and water and vegetables. You know, he stood out.
Absolutely, those are great examples. Yeah. Did somebody, Christy? Did you have?
Oh, I was going to say. I think I had heard Colin Powell even say, you know, that. I want to say he even started, like, sweeping floors, and people noticed how detailed he was in even sweeping floors. I may be getting that story wrong, but it seems like that I had read that somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and some of the things we talked about, I guess, a couple of weeks ago with diligence, you know, whatever we're doing and doing it to the best of our ability. And remember we talked about how diligence is something that just it seems to be easily noticed by others. Laziness is too, unfortunately. But diligence is something that, you know, is noticed by others, and that, you know, will tend to be people in high ranking positions too, right? They'll notice our diligence and the things we do, and it, you know, may lead to us having, you know, prominent positions and things like that because of what they observe. And yeah, I was going to ask for a couple examples, Paula, and you gave a couple really good ones. You said Daniel, you know, he was one of the skilled men chosen in Daniel 1. He rose up to a position of prominence by chapter 6. He's one of the three satraps over the whole kingdom, right? So he certainly rose to a place of prominence. And, you know, how did Nebuchadnezzar and Darius, like, what was their attitude toward Daniel? I mean, he was pretty well respected, right? He was pretty well respected by those kings and those rulers. And yeah, Joseph's another good example. I put down Nehemiah. Yeah, we don't really know much about how he became a cupbearer, but, you know, presumably he brought the same level of diligence and effort to that role that he brought to rebuilding the wall. So, there's a lot of great examples of this one. So if we are, again, diligent, skilled in what we do, and it's, you know, typically going to lead us to be favored by those in high positions. It's kind of, you know, we say a lot, Christians ought to be the best employees, you know, and they really should if we're giving, you know, the diligent effort that we should. It doesn't mean we'll be the employees, you know, working 100-hour weeks or anything like that, but for the appropriate amount of time that we're devoting to our work, we ought to be really, you know, the best or some of the best employees that that there are. Yes, I'm going to again quickly move on. Appreciate all the good thoughts on that one. So here's one that is interesting. Here in 23, verses 1 through 3, does someone mind reading that one?
When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat. If you're a man given to appetite, do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food.
All right. So, again, this one's interesting. I think takes a little pondering to maybe think about what's being said here. And so maybe we can think through this together. I mean, picture the situation here that he's, I think, wanting us to picture. You're dining with a ruler. And think about it, you know, back in those times, and we're talking about, you know, kings, those who are truly, you know, powerful. You're dining with a ruler. What do you think you're going to be having for dinner? You're going to be having peanut butter and banana sandwiches? No, probably not. Do you think that you're going to have, is there only going to be enough there for one serving? Or is there going to be enough for a second helping, a third helping, maybe a fourth if you wanted to? I mean, you can imagine these dinners and these feasts, you know, there's going to be an excessive amount of food, an exorbitant amount of food, drink too. I'm sure the wine will be free flowing. And so picture, you know, a dinner with a king or a ruler. And he says that it's a situation where we need to be careful. He says, observe carefully what's before you and put a knife to your throat. I think, you know, almost certainly a figurative way of saying have some restraint here, right? Have some restraint in this situation. Again, you put a knife to your throat, restrain yourself. If you are given to appetite, I know some of your versions may say gluttony there, may actually put the word gluttony. So restrain yourself if you're given to gluttony. So he's saying that this is a situation where the excess, the exorbitance, you know, the situation may not be good for you. Does that make sense? It may not be good for you. So while it looks good, it may quickly turn into gluttony, right, or drunkenness. It won't turn out well. I think that's what the deceptive part of it is. So, you know, I try to think of examples of like King's Feast. So the one that kept popping up in my mind is in Daniel 5. Do you remember the feast that Belshazzar was having there in Daniel 5 where, okay, they're having a feast, you know, the wine is flowing, and all of a sudden it's descending to the point where they're pulling out like the gold and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem, and they're drinking out of those. And I mean, you can see the downward spiral that a king's feast, when all that excess is there, what can happen. And I think he's saying that, you know, be careful in those situations that you don't give yourself in completely to your appetite or your desires. Again, I, you know, welcome any thoughts or ideas you guys have there, so I'll open it up to you guys.
I tend to think of the delicacies. If you are sitting and eating with men of importance or reputation, you know, you may have a tendency to want to, the delicacies are like gossip or lies and things that can be promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those things are deceptive. The delicacies that you may be given aren't necessarily food. They're right. Thoughts and things that, and behaviors that you may get drawn into. So the knife to your throat is, you know, don't participate in that kind of thing.
Yeah, restrain
and be careful.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's another, I can't remember where it is right now in the book, but it talks about gossip being kind of like these sweet morsels that we desire, right? Maybe we desire them and they look appealing, but does it turn out well for us or for anyone? We'll know. You know, it's the deceptive part of it. Yeah. Yeah, anyone else?
It's also a reminder, don't get wrapped up in the trappings. I mean, we call them trappings, right? Just because somebody is serving lobster and caviar and all these things, like, be careful, because often that's being done to shift the dynamic of the relationship, to say that you're now in debt to me because look how many portions you've filled yourself up with. And so now I'm about to ask you for something, and it's not going to be something that you're going to feel like you want to say yes to, but after having taken and taken and taken, you're going to feel even an extra weight of guilt. And it's like, just watch out for that dynamic.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that's why Chinese people like to do business over the dining table. Mm-hmm. That's one important reason. So they all talk about their business when drinking and eating good food, and I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Give them some of the good food or delicacies, and then really let's get down to business, right? Let me get something from you. Yeah. 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 Again, it's interesting, you know, saying. I really think it takes some pondering, but it's clear that obviously there are situations where things may appear really nice. Again, these delicacies are before us. But it's a time to exercise some caution and don't just give ourselves full bore into it. I tried to think of some other analogies, but I didn't feel good about any of them, so I'm not going to share them. But again, I think the lesson is let's exercise caution when facing a situation like this. All right, lastly here, when it comes to behavior toward rulers, he says here in 24, 21, and 22, my son, fear the Lord and the king, and do not join with those who do otherwise, for disaster will arise suddenly from them, and who knows the ruin that will come from them both. So he says, fear the Lord and the king. Are they on the same level? Well, of course not. But there does need to be respect for the king, for his authority, his position. Doesn't mean that, you know, you have to agree with everything about his character or his decisions, but there's respect for his authority, again, his position. You know, again, I'm going to make this like a Daniel class pretty much, but, you know, do you think Daniel agreed with everything that Nebuchadnezzar did? Well, certainly not, but, you know, Daniel had respect for Nebuchadnezzar, and he spoke with him in a respectful manner. You know, even there, like in chapter 4, where he's telling him that dream interpretation, where he's basically saying, Nebuchadnezzar, God's taking you down a notch, you know, because of your sins. And even then, he's talking to him respectfully. And so, again, you know, we need to certainly respect our rulers. And obviously, there are New Testament teachings that emphasize that as well. And don't spend time with those who don't, he says too, right? So it's not good to spend time with those who don't fear the Lord or fear the king, because that's going to lead to disaster, he says. All right, I'll stop there before we move into another topic. Any other, again, any maybe other sayings that I missed, you guys saw there, that have to do with our behavior or attitude towards rulers?
Hey, James.
Yeah, James, is that you?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about this scripture here. If you have someone that does not have a general respect for authority, mm-hmm. you really don't want to be hanging around them. Because it's not only just, you know, you say the Lord, then the king, you drop down to teachers and other people of authority. You really don't want to be hanging around with those types of people. They're going to try to influence you to do things against authorities. Yep. Like I said, you don't have to agree with personal things in there, but as we know from the New Testament, authority comes from God. And people in the authorities, God has allowed them to be there.
Absolutely. Yeah, well said. You know, we've seen throughout the book just the power of influence by our friends and those who are around us. And again, it's another example of that, right? If we have those around us who don't respect authority, that's only going to lead to bad things for ourselves. All right, I'm going to move into a few here that talk about our attitudes towards evildoers / our enemies. Starting with, I'm going to put a couple up here first, that both talk about not being envious of evil men. Can it be tempting to envy evil men? I mean, I think it certainly can. You know, why would we envy evil men, you think? Or why do we?
Hey.
Yes. You said something, James?
So I've heard it, unfortunately, too many times where some feel that serving God, there's no real, they don't see a benefit in it, but they say, look at these people that are not serving God, and they're able to get ahead, make money, and all these other things. And he says, looking at me just being a Christian, I'm unable to obtain those things. And they're looking at evildoers,
yeah.
Those that reject God, they say they're actually benefiting, and me trying to serve God, I'm not getting any benefit from it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. We see them living, you know, lives of wickedness and nothing's really happening to them. In fact, they're better off than we are, right? Perhaps they're financially in a better place, they just had a better life than us. Maybe we see them living without restraint. Maybe it's appealing to live for yourselves, you know, like they would. But I want to, so both of these passages here, I think you're emphasizing a couple of different things. Like the first one here on the screen, like what's his point about why we shouldn't be envious of evil men? Like in the second part of the verse, or in verse 2.
Yeah, the violence that's going to produce.
Yeah. Yeah, he's emphasizing just how, like, look at how actually, you know, bad this is what they're doing and what it produces, right? The violence, their lips talk of trouble. So I think he's emphasizing, like look at what they're doing for what it really is, like how bad it is, like in the present even. Back in chapter 1 where the first thing the father says to the son after that kind of introduction section, he says, don't be enticed by sinners. He's talking to a young man, and perhaps young people maybe are more prone to this. I don't know if I say that for certain or not, but maybe more prone to being envious of those around him who are doing evil. He says, don't be enticed because look at what they're really doing, the destruction that they're causing to innocent people and all the things he says there. So, you know, see it for what it really is in the present. But then in the second verse here, what's the reasoning there? Well, it's about the future, right? Like, look, the things they're doing, they're not going to last. So like you said, you know, James, it doesn't seem like anything's bad is happening to them. Well, you know, eventually they're not going to have a future. And those who fear the Lord, your hope is not going to be cut off. So why should we not envy them? Well, we'll look at what they're doing now for what it really is. And then also think about, you know, what your future is compared to the lack of future that they would have. Again, I think both those dimensions are important for us to think about.
And Jake, Jesus was given that same temptation by Satan. Look at the mm-hmm. kingdoms of the world, you know? We have to discard the immediate
yeah.
for the future
right.
of eternal life.
That's right. That's right. Yes, absolutely. It's well said. Yeah, I don't have this verse on the screen, but in 24:19 and 20, it's very similar where he says, "Fret not yourself because of evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked, for the evil man has no future. The lamp of the wicked will be put out." All right, so you may look and see, wow, things are going really well. And I think part of the trust in the wisdom of these Proverbs is to know that he's saying that, you know, they actually don't have a future. All right, I'm going to check my time here really quick. 5:36. All right, so here's one in chapter 24. I'll read this one quickly here. "Partiality in judging is not good. Whoever says to the wicked, 'You are in the right,' will be cursed by peoples, abhorred by nations, but those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. Whoever gives an honest answer kisses the lips." And there's certainly a point here regarding honesty and being a true witness. We talked about that last week, about, you know, when you're a witness in a case, there's so many pressures on you to not tell the truth, whether it's bias or revenge or, you know, conflict of interest or public sentiment or whatever it may be, but to, you know, the importance in that, in being a true witness, even if those pressures are on us. But, you know, what he's saying here is that in doing that, or if we're a false witness, in doing that, we may actually be calling something that is wicked, we may be calling it right, right, if we do that. So we need to be careful to call, tell the truth and to call wickedness what it is. I'm going to move quickly on from that one to the next one so we don't run out of time. 24:17-18. He says, "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and let not your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased and turn away his anger from him." All right, so I really like this one. He's saying, of course, that, you know, when bad things happen to our enemies, that it's not a source of joy. This saying is a little unique in that it's pretty direct in saying, like, do this or don't do this because the Lord doesn't like it. You know, not all the Proverbs are that direct. I think that's inherent in these, but this one is saying, don't do this because the Lord will be displeased. And it talks about he may turn his anger from him over to you instead. And I think this this idea, it may seem a little contradictory, like when we read the Psalms and we see psalmists like David who are always asking God to deliver them from enemies and to you know, take care of his enemies. Like you can read Psalm 140 as an example of that. But in thinking about David specifically, like who would you say was David's most prominent enemy?
Saul.
Yeah. Do you remember how he reacted when Saul died?
He wept, didn't he?
Yeah, he was not overjoyed, right, and threw a party. You know, I mean, he specifically wrote, at least a few psalms specifically about, you know, when he was being oppressed and chased by Saul, who clearly was his enemy. Yet, when he died, you know, that messenger came up to him, and I think he was expecting David to be happy with what he had to say, you know, that he, you know, finished Saul off when he was wounded. But David, you know, had the messenger killed, right? And wept over the death of Saul and Jonathan. And, you know, you think about, like, Absalom, too, right? I mean, that's his son, so it may be a little bit different. But Absalom became an enemy, and he was trying to take his kingdom away. Yet when Absalom died, David, it was not a source of joy, but he wept over that. And so, you know, I think we need to see the difference between, again, crying out to God for deliverance when we're being oppressed, and then, you know, our enemy falling or bad things happening to them, and that being a source of joy for us. Philip, is your hand raised?
Yeah. So, like, on a national level, this is the whole message of the book of Obadiah, that the Israelites were rejoicing that Edom was being punished. They say, no, 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 your day is coming too. The same Lord that has punished Edom will one day punish you for your wickedness. So, like, where we might... we might remember this, like David towards Saul, on an individual level. It's also really important to remember on a national level.
Yeah. Any other thoughts or comments?
Jake?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this goes against kind of what's natural for us. I mean, whether it's movies or any kind of thing, you know, the villain, if he gets it in the end, that's like good.
Right.
And this, and you would think that this is how it should be. And the idea that the Lord, although may the person may have been wicked and evil, it breaks his heart if that soul is lost. And so this is on a level that God's trying to get us to understand about human beings. And the made in the image of God, and how important they are to Him, and that we should have the same kind of respect, even for the wicked or the evil, that they're still made in God's image.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. And of course, there's, you know, it kind of points to teachings in the New Testament, right, about loving our enemies. So, I mean, we think that's. It's a consistent message, you know, all the way back to Solomon's time through the things that Jesus taught about caring for those who, you know, even our, again, our enemies and may treat us, you know, unfairly or treat us poorly. We still love them and see them in the way that God sees them, right? You know, like David had opportunities to take care of Saul, but, you know, he saw Saul in the way that God saw him. As, you know, he was his anointed, and he was special, and he wasn't going to touch him when he had that opportunity.
So when I thought about David, I thought about the song we just read. He feared the Lord, and he respected the king. And yeah. So he behaved, and that messenger did not respect the king. He said, hey, I actually finished the king off, and you saw how David dealt with that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good example, yeah, on both those fronts, yeah. The time we have left, there's a couple sayings in here that talk about concern for the less fortunate, for the oppressed. I'll put up a couple here that talk about, our first one says, do not move the ancient landmark that your fathers have set. You guys, I guess, remember or know what landmarks were used for, like what that's referring to? Usually referred to like setting property lines, like when they Deuteronomy talks about and gives warnings about, you know, the inheritance. It's when they got to the promised land, the inheritance was divided up. Well, don't go in and you know, basically move the property line, you know, so your land becomes larger than it should be. And unfortunately, this you know, a lot of times it would happen to those like widows or those who advantage would be taken advantage of those who couldn't defend themselves. And so you essentially, if you're doing that, I mean, what are you doing essentially? You're essentially stealing, right? You're taking what's not yours from those who can't defend themselves. So again, there in the second one gives a little bit more detail. Do not move an ancient landmark or enter the fields of the fatherless, right? So don't take advantage of those, you know, orphans and widows, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their cause against you, right? And I think he's talking about God there. So remember the idea of kind of a Redeemer, like in the story of Ruth and Boaz, you know, like Boaz was the Redeemer. He came in and he, you know, married Ruth, but he comes in and he cares for the widow and provides for them. And so, you know, God is like their provider, right? Takes up their cause, it said. And so We certainly ought not to be people who are taking advantage of those to whom the Lord is taking up their cause. But, you know, I think we know we certainly need to go beyond just not taking advantage of them and be people who, like the Lord, you know, are those who actually look to help those who are in those positions. And then one other passage here that's similar. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and rob of life those who rob them. So again, we see the Lord is kind of, he's there. He's the one that when those people have no one else to depend on, you know, they have God as their redeemer. He's taking up their cause. And so, you know, we certainly need to be careful with you know, taking from them and taking advantage of it. Again, I think, if we're have the relationship with the Lord we've talked about and want to be more like Him, then let's align ourselves to what we see here about God. Right. I think so. Lastly here, I just have again somewhat of a review, but what we can learn about God through this text and. Again, somewhat of a review, but we saw there in the beginning that seeking wisdom leads to greater trust in Him. So, you know, because we see that this wisdom here is you know, the truth, it's the true truth, despite all the other claimed truths out there, really ought to lead to a greater trust in Him. And the Lord is displeased with an inappropriate, I should say, attitude towards our enemies. Right. So, you know, that was the one that was pretty direct in how God felt about it. You know, don't take joy when your enemy falls because God is displeased with it. So it's very direct about how God would feel about that. And, you know, you can maybe think a little bit about what kind of attitude would be behind like being happy in that moment. It may be a attitude that's vengeful, you know, like, you know, I was out to get them. And so, maybe I'm not the one that, you know, took revenge and killed them, but I'm happy that someone did. You know, that really, I think, shows a poor heart and a poor attitude. And so the Lord is displeased when we don't see our enemies as He would have us to. And then the Lord pleads the cause of the less fortunate. As we just saw, Lord is their redeemer. You know, He takes up for the poor, the orphan, the widow, those who can depend on no one else. And then finally, there is a hope and a future in fearing the Lord. So we see those around us, you know, there's so much enticement, and we see like, you know, look, he's living it up, and look how well he's doing financially, and, you know, he's, you know, never has, you know, doesn't seem like he has a care in the world about anything. Just remember that only with the Lord and those who fear the Lord is there actually a future and a hope. So let's remember that. I'll stop there to see if you guys have any comments or thoughts.
One of my very favorite things in this whole section is chapter 24, 30 to 34. Just at the final end, because so much of the lessons in this section, it's a reminder to observe these things. You really highlighted very well, Jake, how we start by seeking truth at the beginning of this section. But he says, I passed by the field of the sluggard, the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, like just opening your eyes, just seeing the way that these things turn out. My brother told me about a preacher back in Tennessee that said, truth is that which conforms to reality, or you know, truth is in alignment with reality. And so as we're seeking truth here, the reality is if you're neglecting this field, then yes, the thorns are going to grow. And if you neglect this field and if you're lazy, then you're not going to be as profitable as you could have been. And a lot of the things in this section really highlight those observable truths, whether it's the drunkenness stuff that you had in the handout or the Lord redeeming and kind of fighting for the helpless. It's really important that we have our eyes open.
Yeah. Well,
great class, man.
Well said. Really,
a fantastic class.
Thank you. Yeah, that's